and I'm a member of EPA Region 10's RCRA Lead Region team. It's my pleasure to introduce you to the RCRA Expert Brown Bag webinar series. This series is an effort to capture and share RCRA institutional knowledge and expertise within the EPA and eventually with our state partners. The audience may be just EPA or EPA and state partners, depending on the topic. Webinars will be offered live on CLUIN and also recorded for future viewing. In this series, RCRA experts will talk about how they know what they know. Speakers will cover what their topic is and why it's important. What are their keys to success? What are some key pieces of advice and lessons learned? Their go-to resources, so tips on the best resources such as guidance documents and training for the particular topic area, and a case study or example application, giving one or more real-life examples to help explain the topic's importance and illustrate the keys to success. Do you want to nominate an expert? The series is being sponsored by the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery and Regions 6, 9, and 10, but we actively welcome your EPA expert nominations. Share your ideas on who should be invited to present on a future webinar by providing the expert's name and topic of expertise. For nominations or questions on the series, contact Lisa MacArthur or Melissa Winters. It's now my pleasure to introduce Cheryl Nelson, our speaker for today, who is presenting Think Before You Dig, How to Make RCRA Work for You in Cleaning Up a Site. Ms. Nelson is currently the supervisor of the Planning and State Development Office for EPA Region 9 in San Francisco. Her office is responsible for grant funding and oversight of RCRA hazardous waste programs for EPA Region 9 states and territories. Ms. Nelson has 30 years experience as an environmental specializing in knowledge and implementation of hazardous waste regulations in both the private sector and the federal government. Her experience encompasses local, state, and federal regulations for handling, storage, treatment, transportation, recycling, permitting, corrective action, and disposal of hazardous waste. Throughout her career, Ms. Nelson has presented at numerous workshops, conferences, trainings, and public meetings, and is a nationally recognized trainer and expert in the hazardous waste regulations. Ms. Nelson has a bachelor's degree in geology from the State University of New York and a master's degree in geology from San Jose State University, California. Welcome, Cheryl, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks, Lisa. Welcome, everybody. This is Cheryl Nelson. So today we're going to talk about Think Before You Dig, how to make RCRA hazardous waste regulations and policies work for you in cleaning up a site. So I'm going to try to introduce, in our short 50 minutes remaining in this webinar, some of the flexible RCRA policies and regulations that can assist you in removing barriers to a full and effective cleanup. And these policies and regulations work regardless of what environment you find yourself in for the site, whether it's a RCRA corrective action site, a Superfund cleanup, a voluntary site. It really doesn't matter. These policies will work for any of those situations. So why is this topic important? Well, throughout my career in both private practice and at EPA as an expert, I've been consulted on numerous cleanup projects. And it's really kind of interesting because the first question that I always get asked is either, every hazardous waste landfill has rejected our waste, what do we do now? Or what remedy can I choose that would avoid RCRA regulation altogether and having to dispose of hazardous waste in a hazardous waste landfill? So I always advise people that these are exactly backwards ways to think about how you would approach a site cleanup. The right way to think about a site cleanup is to begin with the end in mind. The reality is that there are many flexible RCRA policies and regulations that can remove barriers to aggressive and effective cleanup and allow for timely and implementable solutions. The key is that you have to do careful planning ahead of time to invoke these policies or regulations. Too many people just rush to get the stuff out of there, and they end up either out of compliance with RCRA or generating huge amounts of material such as debris, soil, carbon, or water that then has to be disposed as hazardous waste. And in extreme cases, I've actually seen sites that have triggered the need for a full RCRA hazardous waste permit, long-term operation and maintenance costs, disposal costs, and even in some cases, incineration. So the bottom line is that you should think it through before you dig. It's been my experience that the cost of a cleanup can often be dictated by the volume of RCRA hazardous waste that is generated, treated, or disposed, even if that volume is fairly small compared to the overall volume of the other non-hazardous waste generated at a site. So it's worth thinking it through ahead of time and what your overall plan is for cleanup, consistent with your site-specific cleanup objectives, to ensure that you don't unnecessarily generate hazardous waste if you don't have to. So what is the successful cleanup process? Well, first, and I'm going to go into these in more detail in later slides, so I'm just now going to introduce the concepts, and then we'll pause at each one later and give a little more detail. But first, you want to choose your cleanup remedy. This is generally based upon site-specific risk, future land use. It can also include other factors such as post-construction control, community acceptance, cost, and et cetera. And most people that work in the cleanup arena are pretty familiar with that process. Second, you then want to make a waste determination for all of the waste streams at your site and determine which of those might potentially be hazardous waste. Next, you want to determine if the land disposal treatment standards apply or attach to each of these hazardous waste streams. And more importantly, where in the process they attach. What is the point of generation? If these treatment standards attach, you then have to choose which treatment standards apply, and you have choices, and we'll go through some of those choices. And then finally, once you've figured all of that out, you want to work backwards from your chosen remedy to pick the most flexible regulations policies that will work for you and help you successfully apply the treatment standards where applicable. So to sum that up, basically what I've been saying is the successful cleanup process begins with the end in mind. I have found in my career that there's really sort of a hierarchy for how you approach this, and I call it the seven keys to successful cleanup. So I'm going to identify each of these seven steps for you and then walk through each one individually later to give you a little more information. So the first is identify the optimum site remedy based upon the future land use and mitigating site risk. The second, prepare an accurate waste identification under RCRA for all of the potentially contaminated materials at the site. And you can do this by developing and using a site conceptual model to guide your site characterization and the identification of the waste. Third, you want to work backwards from the remedy to find the best RCRA flexible policy or pathway that will get you to that solution. Fourth, you want to look at some flexible policies, such as the contained in policy and the area of contamination policy. These will help you avoid triggering the land disposal treatment standards unnecessarily if you don't need to. Fifth, you want to use the alternative LDR treatment standards that might be at your, you might be able to use, such as treatment standards for contaminated soil or for hazardous debris. These can help you significantly reduce the need to treat these materials when these standards can't be avoided. You could also look at a site-specific LDR treatment variant, which can help you if it's unachievable to meet the standard or inappropriate to do so, and we'll give you some examples of those. Sixth key to success is to use the generator treatment or other RCRA recycling or treatment exclusions to avoid having to get a RCRA permit. And as many of you may already know, the RCRA program is full of these exclusions, and so it's worth taking the time to go through them individually to see if any of these might apply to your situation. And then last, and of course, not least and very important, is you need to document all of these decisions that you're making in your public documents and your statement of basis, so that when you're ready to go out for public comment, folks that would be interested in this site, all of your stakeholders can see your decision-making process and can comment on it. So let's start with the first key to success. And again, in this webinar, I'm only trying to give you some of these resources that I use that I find particularly useful. Maybe some of you have others out there that you've used. I actually teach this class in about 10 hours. So in a one-hour webinar, I'm not going to be able to teach you everything you need to know, but I'm hopefully going to be to give you some of the keys to success and some of the resources that I use that can help you. And then you'll also find, if you download this presentation, in the speaker notes, You'll be able to have more information that helps guide you step by step through some of these more complicated subjects. So the first key to success and some of the resources that I go to is identify the optimum site remedy based upon your future land use and mitigating site risk. So when you're choosing a site remedy, you should primarily base your initial decision on the significant factors such as risk, future land use, public acceptance, all of the things that you look at when you choose a site remedy. There are enough flexible RCRA policies that can help you remove costly barriers to implementing this remedy that, quote, avoidance, unquote, of RCRA shouldn't be a significant factor in your decision. But in my experience, most people, that's usually the first thing they look for. But I really don't think that that's necessary. So some of the key references that I've provided here, the first one is presumptive remedies. There's a nice handy webpage that EPA has under their Superfund program that gives you a lot of different information about remedies that have been used at other sites for certain contaminants. So that's a really useful place to take a look. I've also provided a link to the Handbook of Groundwater Protection and Cleanup Policies for RCRA Corrective Action. So if you have a site that happens to have groundwater contamination, this is a really good source to help look at some potential remedies. And the third link that I've provided there is to the RCRA Subpart S Corrective Action Guidance, which never became official regulation, but is still out there and available for guidance and can be pretty useful in helping you think about ways to do a cleanup at a site. The second key to success is to prepare an accurate waste identification under RCRA. And you want to do this for all of the potentially contaminated materials at a site. And this is generally done by developing and using some sort of conceptual site model to help you guide where you're going to take your samples and how you're going to do your characterization and how you're going to identify each of your wastes. So for this one, there's a lot involved in this, and this is a very significant step in the process. So you don't want to minimize the amount of time that it takes to do this accurately. And you want to make a list of all of the possible and probable wastes. And you don't want to forget things like contaminated soil, groundwater, spent carbon from a treatment system, personal protective equipment, building debris, the list can go on and on. So you want to be pretty comprehensive and make sure you're thinking about all of the different things. And then for each one of these waste streams, you want to do an initial think through of what you would, whether you think that waste stream could potentially be hazardous and what kind of sampling and analysis that you might do. For potentially hazardous waste that could have a significant impact on your project cost, you need to think about which types of sampling and testing that you're going to perform. And you need to be aware that the types of sampling that you might do at this stage to determine whether or not something is hazardous would be very different than the type of sampling and analysis that you might do later when you're attempting to determine a landfill, for example, if you're disposing it in a landfill might be appropriate. So you need to think that through. And then usually there comes a point in time when you're doing this that you have to kind of do a back of the envelope, quick cost-benefit analysis, determine whether it's even worth the effort to do this additional sampling or not. If it's a very small amount of material that is potentially hazardous, it might make sense to just assume it is hazardous and manage it as such, instead of trying to spend a lot of time and energy and money doing sampling that would tell you otherwise. So you have to kind of weigh the cost and benefit of that. You need to also include in that analysis whether or not you're going to trigger a land disposal treatment standard and what the cost would be of that. And we'll talk more about that later. Finally, when you have a site that could have potentially contaminated media, like soil and groundwater, you're going to want to consult the contained in policy, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. And it really is important at this step that you do this before you start digging anything up, and we're going to talk about why. And finally, when you do conduct all of your sampling analysis, once you've gotten that data back and you've had a chance to take a look at it, that's where you then want to go back to your initial assumptions on whether or not you thought those wastes were initially hazardous or not, and using that data then determine which streams actually are hazardous. And I've listed here on this slide some key references that might help you. The first is the Definition of Solid Waste webpage. This is a handy little webpage that actually has a nice little tool on it that, if you haven't already seen it, it's pretty cool. that walks you through how you do a waste determination. There's a link here to the contained in policy, which we're going to talk about in a minute. There's also a link here to the RCRA online database, which if you haven't seen this, is a nifty little tool. It basically has all of EPA's key policy documents, letters, and various interpretations. It's really helpful. And there's a link to EPA's wedge page for the site conceptual model. So tips for identifying contaminated media. So this gets a little complicated, and I can't go into a lot of detail in this short seminar, but I'll give you a few tips. So environmental media, such as soil, groundwater, and sediment, are not solid waste by definition under RCRA, and hence they cannot be hazardous waste if they are contaminated. However, under EPA's contained in policy, contaminated environmental media can become subject to regulation under RCRA if they contain hazardous waste. And there are two circumstances under which this might happen. The first is that they in themselves exhibit a characteristic of hazardous waste. So say you have a contaminated soil or groundwater, and as it exists in its contaminated state, it exhibits a characteristic of hazardous waste, such as ignitability or corrosivity, reactivity, or toxicity. The second situation is when you might have a contaminated media, such as soil or groundwater, that's been contaminated with a listed hazardous waste. And if the concentrations of those constituents are above health-based levels, then that media would contain that waste and you would have to manage it as a RCRA hazardous waste. So the second question I usually get from folks at this point is, how do I know or how do I figure out if my environmental media is contaminated with a listed hazardous waste? And here, what I refer people to is, you don't necessarily have to assume that you have a listed hazardous waste, but you have to do your due diligence to determine if you might have a listed hazardous waste. You might have to go into historical records at your site, talk to people who worked at the facility, look at some of the processes they had here, and make an educated guess or look for evidence that they might have had a listed hazardous waste that they were using at the site. Once you determine whether you have a listed hazardous waste, and let's say you suspect that you do, the next important thing is to determine, understand the relationship between when that listed hazardous waste was spilled versus the effective date of when that listed hazardous waste became subject to RCRA. So for example, if you had a listed hazardous waste, such as an F001, you could look in the regulations to determine when that particular listed waste was listed. In other words, when it became subject to RCRA. If you had an F001 chemical at your site and you spilled it prior to the date that it was listed and you haven't yet picked up or generated the waste, you haven't dug up the soil or brought up the groundwater, you haven't yet generated a waste. And then the flip is also true. If, for example, you spilled or have that listed hazardous waste and at the time you spilled it, it was already subject to regulation, and then you've already got a listed hazardous waste on your hands, and it's already been generated because it existed at the time it was spilled. So this is kind of a complicated and important concept, which is illustrated in tabular form in the next slide, so it kind of guides you a little bit. So this table was developed with three basic principles in mind that I tried to just explain to you, and it's a little more detailed in this table. The first thing you need to understand is that all hazardous waste are currently prohibited from land disposal under 40 CFR 268 subpart C, unless and until those wastes meet their applicable land disposal restriction treatment standards. The second concept that you need to understand is that once a decision has been made to generate and land dispose contaminated environmental media, such as soil, groundwater, or sediment, those standards generally apply only to contaminated environmental media that contain hazardous waste or that exhibit a hazardous characteristic. So again, under those two circumstances I talked about earlier, if it already exhibits a characteristic or if it contains a listed hazardous waste. And then the third thing that this table is attempting to show you is that once the LDR is attached to any given hazardous waste, then they continue to apply until you satisfy them. You can't unattach them once a standard attaches. basically, once you've opened that door, you have to walk through it and complete the treatment before you can then dispose that waste. And you can't just treat that waste to get it below the characteristic level. You have to treat it all the way down to the land disposal treatment standard, which in many cases is below the level that would otherwise trigger that waste to be characteristic. So I know this table is a lot to take in a few short minutes, but I'll walk you through one of the cases to give you a little bit of an example. So if we take this first case, this first line here, if the LDRs applied to the waste at the time it contaminated the soil, so in this case, if you had a listed hazardous waste, it was regulated by RCRA at the time that it was spilled, and if now those LDRs apply, which they do, then you must comply. So in other words, if that waste was spilled at that site at the time when that waste was regulated, you still have to comply with the standards. And in fact, right now, what you have is a listed hazardous waste contaminated at your site. If we look at the third line in that table, if we say that that waste at the time it was spilled wasn't listed under RCRA, and now that waste is listed, the soil is determined not to contain this listed hazardous waste when you first generate it, then you don't need to comply with the LDRs. This is the key case, and here's where you want to apply the contained in policy. So if you have an example where something was spilled, say, in the 1960s, long before it was listed under RCRA, but that waste is now regulated, the soil hasn't yet been dug up. So if you can apply the contained in policy before you generate or dig up that soil, and if you are successful in applying that policy and determining that that soil no longer contains that waste, then once you dig it up, the LDRs never attach and don't apply. So that's kind of a key case, and it's significant. And so I think it's worth, when you have a site with that potential, that you take a close look at that before you dig things up. So what is the third key to success? Basically, you want to work backwards from the remedy that you've just chosen to find the best RCRA flexible policy and pathway to get there. And I've attached here two references that might help you with that. The first is the history of the RCRA Corrective Action Program. It gives you a broad view of the program and kind of how it works. And the second is really key. And if you haven't seen this one already, I recommend that you download this because it's really helpful. It's the Management of Remediation Waste under RCRA. This was a memo that came out in October of 1998. It's still very useful, hasn't been superseded. It's my Bible. I have mine laminated and sitting on my desk. It's about 14 pages, and it pulls together in one place all of these different flexible policies and regulations that I've been talking about. And then it gives you references for how to go back and find more information. So it's pretty useful. All right, so moving on to the fourth key to success. This is where you want to take a close look at the contained in policy and the area of contamination policy. And these can help you avoid generating waste and or triggering the treatment standards unnecessarily. So the key here is that these two things are policies, so you're not going to find them in any regulation anywhere. But I've provided the links for you on the previous slide and this one so that you can find them. What you need to be careful with here is that states that are authorized for the RCRA program can have regulations that are broader in scope or more stringent than EPA. So you need to consult with the approved state program before you start invoking these policies. Under the contained in policy, again, this applies to any potentially hazardous environmental media, such as soil, groundwater, or sediment, and it helps clarify when that media contains a list of hazardous waste and must therefore be managed as a hazardous waste. And the flip side is when that media no longer contains that listed hazardous waste and when you don't have to manage it as hazardous waste. And generally, the policy says that to make that decision, you need to know the concentrations of all of the constituents that might be in that environmental media, compare those against what that waste was listed for, and then compare those concentrations against some recognized health-based limit. And if you can successfully do that before you dig it up, you might, in fact, allow yourself to not trigger RCRA. Let me say that again. If you can successfully apply that policy before you generate the waste, you can avoid RCRA altogether. And we talked about that on the last slide. The key then is to think about it, think it through, look at your data, and apply that policy before you dig it up, and then to document all of your logic and your analyses in your record of decision. And then finally, you might have debris at your site. And debris is a slightly different special case. And just like the contained in policy, the debris, if you're managing debris that's potentially contaminated with a listed hazardous waste, or if it exhibits a characteristic, it also must be managed as if it were hazardous waste. And there is an analogous, it's actually a regulation in 40 CFR 261.3 for debris that you can actually exit the RCRA program. And the way this works is if you go in and take a look, it explains that if you use one of the required treatment standards for that debris that involves extraction or destruction of those contaminants, and you can do that successfully by meeting the performance standard in that debris standard, you can exit the RCRA program and you don't need to manage that debris as RCRA hazardous waste. And then finally, the area of contamination policy. This one's pretty handy. I find that it's misused a lot, so you want to read it carefully to make sure that you're well within the parameters of the policy. But generally what this policy says is that if you have an area of your site that's contaminated, if you manage that contaminated media in situ within that general area of contamination, you're not generating the waste and you're not triggering the treatment standards. The keys you have to remember here is that you can only manage the waste in situ, which means you can't dig it up and containerize it or move it to another location on your site. This policy, I find, is pretty useful if you're consolidating contaminated materials into a smaller footprint and or if you're treating those materials in situ at your site. So it can be pretty helpful. I've also provided a link on this slide for the compilation of guidance on remediation waste policies. It's another handy website that will walk you through a variety of policies that EPA has on its website. Okay, so the fifth key to success. This is where once you've determined that you cannot avoid triggering or generating hazardous waste and therefore you cannot avoid triggering the land disposal treatment standards, the next thing you want to do is look carefully at the standards that are available to you. So if you have contaminated soil, for example, there is an alternative LDR treatment standard that you can look at that's a bit more generous, it's easier to meet, than the regular treatment standard. And in some cases, it might not require any treatment at all if the contaminated soil as it exists, is below this standard. So if you look this up in 40 CFR 268.49, what the alternative soil standard says is that you have to achieve 90% reduction in concentration of contaminants, and this is based on total concentrations for most nonmetals and soluble concentrations for most metals. But that is capped by, in other words, you don't have to go any lower than 10 times the universal treatment standard for that contaminant. But you must also ensure that the contaminated soil no longer exhibits a characteristic of ignitability, corrosivity, reactivity, or toxicity. So you have to also treat to eliminate the characteristic. I find that this alternative standard is pretty useful in situations where I have very high concentrations initially, so I only have to achieve 90% reduction, but I don't have to go any lower than 10 times the universal treatment standard. I also find it works pretty handy if I have very low concentrations that I might already have met the standard. The key that you have to remember here is that you not only have to treat for the main constituents for which the soil is hazardous, but also for any underlying hazardous constituents that might exist in that soil. And underlying hazardous constituents are generally identified as constituents that have an initial concentration that are 10 times above their universal treatment standard. So you want to look at all of the contaminants that are potentially in your contaminated soil. If after going through all of this, you still find that you cannot meet an applicable standard, either physically, because there's no technology that exists that will do it, or practically, it's way too expensive, or it's discouraging aggressive removal, or would require you to incinerate a large volume of soil, you can seek a site-specific variance for a treatment standard. And what happens here is an alternative standard is set. And depending on what standard is set as your alternative, you might find that your material as it exists as is already below that alternative treatment standard, rendering treatment moot. And there's all kinds of great Superfund guidance that I've provided here on this page that explains exactly how you would apply for such a treatment standard and the considerations that the agency goes through in deciding whether or not to grant it. Again, if you have contaminated debris, one thing I find that's useful at this point is that you kind of weigh the cost-benefit of either treating that debris to meet the alternative standard and then exiting the RCRA-C program, or just managing it as hazardous right from the beginning if it's a very small volume and isn't very costly to dispose of. You want to note that the alternative treatment standards for debris are technology and performance-based, and they vary depend upon the physical nature of the debris and the chemical nature of the contaminant. So it's important here, if you're applying one of these standards or if you're overseeing a site where someone else is applying the standard, that you want to look carefully at the performance standard and whether or not the treatment meets that standard. And in the regulations themselves, it gives very detailed guidance on this. If your hazardous debris happens to be contaminated with a listed hazardous waste, I mentioned earlier that if you treat that debris using one of the extraction or destruction technologies, you can render that debris non-hazardous and remove it from the RCRA-C program. And that's in 40 CFR 261.3. So what is the sixth key to success? If at this point you can't avoid triggering treatment standards, and you find that it's cost-effective to treat the waste on-site, then you want to think carefully about what type of treatment unit you're going to need. And there are several options available to you that would not require a full hazardous waste permit. So one of the things I mentioned earlier that you want to look at first is the area of contamination policy. This generally allows treatment in situ without triggering LDRs or minimum technology standards and without a permit. The key is that you can't dig this up and containerize it or move it to another part of your site. You essentially have to treat it in situ within the area of contamination where it exists. But you can consolidate in that area and move it around to facilitate in situ treatment. Another thing you might want to look at is the generator treatment policy, which I've provided a link for here. This is basically an exclusion that if the treatment can be done in a tank or a container within the 90-day clock of accumulation, and you're conforming to all of the generator tank and container storage requirements, you can do this treatment without a permit. And what I find here is that this generally works for things like simple neutralization or other things like that. Generally, you won't be able to use this policy if you are trying to do some kind of treatment that involves the application of heat, for example. You also want to take a close look. There are a number of exclusions in 40 CFR 261.4, and if you have a special case at your site, you can go through each of those exclusions to see if any of those might apply to your specific situation. It only takes a few minutes to go through those, and if you find one that works for you, that's great. So it's worth taking a look at that list. Next, if you've exhausted all previous resources, you might want to consider things like a corrective action management unit, a temporary unit, or staging pile. And these are all delineated in 40 CFR 264 subpart F. And these units have to be invoked by the EPA or the state in some sort of enforceable document, which could be an order, and they don't require a full permit. There are technology requirements that apply and storage limits that apply, but if you have a large volume of material that you're trying to manage on your site, one or more of these might work for you. There's also emergency permits, CERCLA response actions and immediate responses to spills generally don't require a permit. So if you're doing some sort of emergency response or emergency removal, you might take a look at those and they might be helpful to you. And then finally, if all else fails and you still have to get a permit, there are a couple of ways you can consider that. You can look at permits by rule, you can look at emergency permits, you can look at standardized permits, or you can look at remedial action plans, all of which are delineated in 40 CFR Part 270, so Part F. And many of those, I kind of call those RCRA lite. They're all a form of a permit, but they're generally a little bit easier to get than a full-blown RCRA permit. If you have a site that you're working on that already has a full-blown RCRA permit for some other reason, you might consider whether you could just use that permit and do some sort of permit modification to cover whatever treatment you need to do at your site. All right, the seventh key to success. Obviously, you want to document all of your decisions and policies in your public documents and your statement of basis. And I've provided a couple of links here that might be helpful to you. One is on the statement of basis and some examples there, and the other is our risk-based clean closure guidance that EPA has on their website. And so no matter how you end up at your final remedy, it's imperative that you not only document all of this, but that you make it available for public review and comment. And this is especially true even if you're doing an interim or a partial remedy that you haven't yet sought public comment on. So I'm going to take a pause there for a minute and ask if there are any questions that have come up or anything I can elaborate on before we can move on, and then we'll do another break at the end to take questions. Lisa, do we have any questions that folks have been chiming in on?
Absolutely, Cheryl. We have some good ones. One question is, do any of the resources that you cite talk about treatment options for different wastes, including pros and cons for the different treatment options?
Yes. I think the best resource that I've cited for that was on a previous slide that had the presumptive remedies under the Superfund program. So some of those resources in that link do talk about presumed remedies for certain types of contaminants and how successful they've been. So absolutely, I would take a look at that resource.
Great. Thank you. And another question is, how long does it take to get a permit?
It depends on the type of permit. If we're talking a full-blown RCRA permit, I mean, I have to tell you, there have been some sites that have taken many, 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 many years to do that. I think some states have gotten it down to about 2 years is about the minimum I've seen, so it's a lot of work. That's why I'm suggesting that you don't want to go there. That's sort of a last resort. And even if you do ultimately need to get a permit, you probably don't want a full RCRA permit. You probably want to look at one of the streamlined permits or a remedial action plan type permit. That is actually a bona fide RCRA permit, but it's streamlined. It still requires public comment, but it doesn't trigger site-wide corrective action across your entire site. You can limit it to just the area of contamination that you're trying to manage and clean up.
Thanks. And maybe we'll take one more and then take the rest at the end. Someone asked, can you provide an example of applying the contained-in policy before digging up the soil? They don't really understand what you mean by applying the policy.
Yes, that's a complicated one. And I do have an example that I'm going to go through at the end of this presentation that'll go through that in a little more detail. So if I could hold that question until I get to that part, I'll walk through that.
Exactly. Okay, and so maybe just one more. Have you had experience with remedial action plans, and how streamlined do they turn out to be? In other words, how much faster are they than a full permit?
Yes, I've had experience. We had one here in Region 9 where we did a remedial action plan for a site out on one of the Outer Pacific Islands. And as I recall, we were able to draft that up, get it out for public comment, and finalize it in a relatively short period of time. As I recall, it was under a couple of months. I want to say it was about 3 to 4 months that we did that.
Great, thank you. And so we'll just encourage folks to keep sending in questions, and then there'll probably be more at the end.
Okay, great. So we'll go on, and I have an example case study at the end that we can walk through in a little more detail that walks through the application of the contained in policy that hopefully will help bring that home a little bit. So some other resources that I find useful that I want to throw in here is there is a main web page that EPA has for the Corrective Action Program, and a lot of the individual resources that I pointed out earlier stem from this main web page. So you might want to go in and take a look at that. For folks that aren't familiar with it, we do have a national RCRA information network called the RIN. This is a national network of both EPA and states. Everyone who works for either EPA or a state regulatory program is welcome to attend. We host calls the first Wednesday of every month at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And if you don't already know about this or want to get introduced to it or get on the list, Jim O'Leary, who is in our EPA headquarters office, is the guy to contact. And even if you don't have time to sit in on the calls, it's really useful just to get on the email list, because a lot of people will email their questions or thoughts that they have on a particular project, and other people will weigh in, and so you'll get a lot of back and forth on the email. There's also a web page on the use of RCRA ARARs at Superfund sites that's a little bit handy, and then there's another page for the RCRA Corrective Action Enforcement Authorities that you might want to take a look at. So let's dive into our case study and an example. This is actually a real case that I worked on here in Region 9, so nothing in here is made up, as strange as it may sound. This is real. So I want you to imagine that you are the lead regulator for a site, and this particular site formerly operated as a vapor degreaser from 1980 to 1992. And because of those operations, it resulted in extensive contamination of tetrachloroethylene, or PCE, in the soil beneath the building that held the degreaser. And believe it or not, the person who owned the site came in voluntarily to the state that was authorized for the RCRA program and said that he wanted to clean up the site himself, and he was going to sell the site, and he had a potential buyer who was going to buy it and turn it into a daycare center. And the state set a cleanup level of 5 parts per million for the PCE at the site. So they went out and they did some sampling at the site, and they found that the concentrations ranged from non-detect in some areas, and the highest they were able to find was 450 parts per million of PCE. So the owner's proposed remedy was to demolish the building, excavate the contaminated soil above the cleanup level of 5 parts per million, and then dispose everything to a local Subtile D landfill. And part of the reason he proposed to put all this into a Subtitle D landfill is because in this particular state, there are no RCRA hazardous waste landfills. So this was the closest landfill that he could find. So if you are the lead person for the site, the question is this acceptable? And the state came to me and said, where do we begin? They didn't know what to do with this. So I want you to begin to think about these 4 questions, and we're going to walk through them. The first is, what are the potential waste streams for this site? Are any of them hazardous? And the second is, are any of the waste potentially subject to the land disposal treatment standards? The third is, what do you think of this proposed remedy? What additional requirements or information which do you need or would you impose? And what other options do you think the owner has to avoid triggering some of the costly RCRA regulations? So here's the solution, and I'll walk through it. And I had to condense quite a bit on these slides to get it to fit. So I'm going to walk through in my explanation a little more than what's condensed on the slide to hopefully make this clear. So what are the potential waste streams? So obviously, you've got PCE, and you've got contaminated soil with this PCE. So if you look up tetrachloroethylene, you will discover that it's an F001 waste. So we know that the site was used as a vapor degreaser. And so if you look up in the regulations F001, you'll see that this is pretty much a listed hazardous waste that was potentially used at the site, so you don't need to do a lot of research to determine, yes, in fact, you do have a listed hazardous waste. And then the second thing you want to look at is, when was this F001 potentially regulated? So in order to figure that out, you need to look up the date of when it was listed. And you do this in 40 CFR. Let's see, where's my reference here? Yeah, 40 CFR 268 Appendix 7. So if you do that and you look that up, you will find that F001 was first subject to RCRA regulation in 1986. So if you go back to the first slide, when was the site used? It was used from 1980 to 1992. So somewhere between 1980 and 1992, in fact in 1986, that contaminant, that PCE became listed. You don't know, because he hasn't provided you with enough information to also make the determination of whether or not the soil exhibits a characteristic. And the most likely characteristic that it might exhibit is D039. And in order to determine that, you'd have to get the owner to go back and to do testing using the toxicity TCLP procedure to see if perhaps it's popping for D039. The degreaser and the building, if he's planning to demolish these become debris, and they are potentially contaminated with listed waste, F001, and they could also potentially exhibit a characteristic for D039. So here's where you want to look at the application of the contained in policy for the media. So remember, this waste was first listed in 1986. But this contaminant was spilled between 1980 and 1992. That's when the site was operated. You don't know exactly when the spills occurred, but you can probably surmise that it occurred all through that time frame. And so in this particular case, it appears that based on the application of the contained in policy, that this waste, this F001, was spilled after the date of listing, which was 1986. Which means that at the time it was spilled, it was subject to regulation, which means that the environmental media contains the listed hazardous waste. Now let's consider the flip side. Let's say that this site stopped operating in 1984 instead of 1992. And let's say same set of circumstances, that had F001, because that listed hazardous waste wasn't listed until 1986, if it was spilled prior to that, between 1980 and 1984, it wasn't yet subject to regulation. So at the time that that PCE contaminated that soil, it wasn't yet RCRA regulated, which means if you do nothing, if you don't disturb the soil, you haven't yet generated a waste. That means the environmental media does not contain a waste yet. If you go to dig up that soil, then you've generated that waste, and it would at that time be subject as an F001. But let's say you haven't dug it up yet, and you sample it, and you look at the individual constituents. The next thing you want to do is go to Table 7 in 40 CFR 261 to see exactly which constituents F001 was listed for. So if you go in there and you look up that table, you will see a list of constituents for which that waste was listed. And I've got that down here in this bullet point where it starts with tetrachloroethylene, methylene chloride. Those are all the constituents. If at that time the concentrations of each of those constituents is below some recognized health-based limit, then applying the contained in policy, you can say that that media no longer contains those constituents, that listed waste, and you can say that that environmental media does not contain a listed hazardous waste. Then you'd also have to determine that it doesn't exhibit a characteristic. And if you can do both of those things and document that decision before you dig it up, then at the time that you dig it up, it wouldn't be generated as a hazardous waste, and it wouldn't be subject to regulation. So that's why it's so important. In this particular case, though, they already generated it, because it was regulated at the time that it was spilled. So do the treatment standards apply? Again, the site operated from 1980 to 1992, and therefore the chemicals were spilled both prior to and after the effective date of listing. Therefore, the wastes were subject to the standards at the time it was spilled in 1986. The LDR standards therefore attach when the spill occurred, and now they must be satisfied. So for the soil, you can now look at either the regular treatment standard for F001, which is found in 40 CFR 268.4, or the alternative treatment standard, which would say 90% reduction or 10 times the universal treatment standard, which would give you a little bit of a break. For the debris, you can either meet the regular numeric standards for F001, or you might want to look at the alternative debris standards in 268.45. So is the proposed remedy acceptable? The contaminated soil and potentially contaminated debris are both listed hazardous waste in this case and subject to the LDRs. Therefore, without treatment and a contingent decision, the soil and debris cannot be disposed in a local subtitle deed landfill, but must be managed and disposed as hazardous waste. So his plan to put it in a subtitle D landfill, not so good. So what additional requirements would apply? Well, the owner would be subject to the RCRA generator regulations when he starts generating these things. So he would have to have an ID number. He would have to manage and store the waste as hazardous, either drum it, label it, less than 90-day accumulation. And at the time when he was ready to offer this waste for disposal off-site, he'd have to manifest it to a permitted treatment, storage, and disposal facility. What are some other options he might have? He could segregate soil during excavation to minimize the amount that must be disposed as hazardous. He could look at whether treating the soil in place to meet the standards might be beneficial. There might be some cost benefit to that. And if he could do that successfully, he could then not have to manage it under Subtitle C, but could in fact manage it in Subtitle D. He could consolidate soil inside the area of contamination. He could use the generator treatment standard policies if he wants to pick it up and put it in tanks or containers, or he could petition for an LDR variance. The debris, he would have to treat using the destruction and removal standard and then contain it out or dispose it to a Subtitle D landfill. Or if it's metal debris, he can look at possibly reclaiming it as scrap metal or reusing it. He could consolidate soil in the area of contamination and treat it in situ to meet LDRs and then perhaps cap it. If he's capping it, if capping is not protective or if the area of contamination is not contiguous, he could build a CAMU or he could get a permit, a RCRA permit, a RAP, or an order. So lots of options there. What ended up happening with this site is he ended up treating it on site in tanks or containers. He was able to do that within the generator treatment standards, the generator treatment exclusion, and then he was able to exit the RCRA C controls and dispose of it in a RCRA C landfill. So finally, just some lessons learned. You want to really think things through before you dig. In some cases, digging up contaminated soil generates the soil to become a hazardous waste. Once it's generated, you can't ungenerate it. If that soil or waste is subject to land disposal restriction standards, then you might have triggered the need to treat the soil and waste. Some treatment standards require incineration that could add exponentially to the cost of the cleanup. Even without treatment, the cost of hauling and disposing adds significantly to your site cleanup. Once you've generated the waste, the 90-day clock starts ticking that requires you to remove the soil or the waste from the site and treat and dispose it at a RCRA hazardous waste facility unless you have some other permit or ability to store it on site. If you run out that 90-day clock, you then trigger the need for a RCRA permit, and this could also add exponentially to the time and cost. And you can often avoid many of these triggers if you just think it through first before you dig. So some important take-home messages. Decide what the right thing to do is for the site cleanup, given the future use of your property first. Work backwards from this outcome to ensure that all the aspects of the cleanup are planned before proceeding. Identify if you have any hazardous waste or hazardous waste contaminated media or debris debris and where and how much, and then use the RCRA flexible policies and regulations to help avoid triggering unnecessarily RCRA regulation and disposals in order to reduce your costs. Think it through before you dig.
Thank you, Cheryl. That was wonderful. And for folks on the line, we may go just a few minutes over the hour, so I appreciate you staying on if you're able, and we should be wrapping up in just about 5 minutes. Cheryl, do you feel ready to take a couple questions?
Absolutely.
So one question is, does the contained bin policy apply to characteristic waste?
Yes and no. I'll say it this way. It applies to any environmental media, contaminated soil, groundwater, or sediment. So you want to look carefully at both whether something contains a listed hazardous waste and or if it's exhibiting a characteristic. So if you do not have a potentially listed hazardous waste and your environmental media is only characteristic, the policy still applies. But it's that case is much simpler than if you have a case with a listed hazardous waste. I'll say it that way.
Great, thank you. And we had one question about understanding your definition of in situ, and how can you consolidate without moving?
So you can, under the area of contamination policy, you can consolidate and move things within the general area of contamination. And so, for example, I've seen sites where they use bulldozers or scrapers to generally push things around and sort of consolidate them in one area. What you can't do is pick it up and put it on a pad or in a container or in a tank or pick it up and move it to another part of your site. So there's some nuances in there, and different states and regions have slightly different how they define that. Generally, what I tell people is it can't daylight. So if you're picking it up off the ground and there's daylight between where you picked it up from and where you're moving it to, then that's not okay. But if it's generally you're just moving it or pushing it around within the area of contamination, you're okay.
Great. Thank you. And how about one more question and then we'll wrap up. This question is regarding LDRs. If there's a numeric and an alternative treatment standard, wouldn't you have to meet the lower or most conservative of the two?
It depends on which standard you're choosing. So if you have, for example, contaminated soil, you have a choice. You can either meet the regular LDR treatment standard, which are generally numeric standards based on best demonstrated available technology, or you can look at the alternative soil standards. And the whole reason the alternative soil standards were developed were to make it a little bit easier because contaminated soil is a little bit different. Some of the treatment technologies that are defined that were considered best available treatment technologies don't, in fact, work on contaminated soil. So the alternative soil standards were designed to be specific to contaminated soil. And if that standard works better for you, then absolutely you can choose to do that.
Expert in your field?
Oh, about 30 years. I worked on many, many, many sites. And I've actually been teaching this class for many years. It was very difficult to put it into a one-hour webinar, and I apologize to those folks who have lots more questions and want to learn more. My contact information is available. You're free to give me a call if you need assistance. And I do, in fact, teach this class in a kind of an eight-hour format that goes into a lot more detail and gives people really hands-on on how to walk through some of these policies and regulations. What I was attempting to do today is just give people a flavor and the key resources that I have that help me do that.
Fantastic. Thank you, Cheryl, and I really appreciate your time and your expertise today. So at this point, I would like to ask folks to make a note to join us next time on October 29th, 2015, from 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern for our next topic, which is how does a rookie survive state authorization? And this will be presented by Wayne Ropey from the EPA Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery and Alima Patterson from EPA Region 6. And attendance for this webinar, we're going to open up to both EPA and state partners. So feel free to share the registration link when you get that with your state partners. And then our next one planned will be on January 6, 2016, from 12 to 1 Eastern, and that one is called Zen and the Art of Permit Writing by Dave Bardis in EPA Region 10. And I'd like to thank you again for joining today's live webinar, and I'd like to remind participants that slides and other items related to today's session can be found on the seminar resources page. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. Also, associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling that out, and that applies to those watching the recorded version of today's session as well. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. And furthermore, today's session was recorded, and you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive in approximately 2 weeks. You will receive an email once the archive is available to you. So with that, I'd like to say thank you to Cheryl, and thank you to all of you for tuning in.
Thanks, everybody. I appreciate your attendance.
This will be the formal conclusion of today's live broadcast.